listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 24th installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy and history of the Soviet Union. Luciana, welcome back. Pleasure to speak with you as always.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yep.
So, pleasure all mine, Don.
Thank you. And so we're still on the topic of Lenin and Trotsky. We're looking at the years from 1903 to 1917. And let's pick it up where we left off last time.
Okay. Just for a bit of summary, we are still on the topic of Lenin and Trotsky, and the years are from 1903 to 1917. Our general agenda for the nearest future are the years 1903 to 1917, and we break it down into significant periods. 1903, when the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks split within the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party.
Right.
And then we go to 1905, where we are still at, and then we move to 1906, 1914, and then 1917.
Right.
Okay. So we are still discussing the 1905 revolution.
And we had gotten to Moscow, I think. We were looking at Lenin's critique of what had happened.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in 1906, he published a critique of the events, the major centers of which were, this is 1905, were Petersburg and Moscow.
Right, so Petersburg, just to recap real quick, so in 1905 in Petersburg, at the beginning of the year, you had what turned into more or less an uprising, or almost an uprising, a great deal of discontent.
Oh, no, in Petersburg you had demonstrations and strikes heading for a general strike.
Right, and then towards the end of the year, this phenomenon reached Moscow, and what Lenin did was critique what had happened. So now, go ahead.
Yeah, we have bookends. We have Petersburg in January 1905, heading for a general strike, and then Trotsky arrives around February and makes speeches, etc., but calls off the general strike for fear that there will be violence on the part of the state, which had already occurred on, January 9th, according to probably our calendar, January 22, according to their calendar. So in Petersburg, you have a kind of retreat from acceleration of events, from escalation. Well, in Moscow, it starts with demonstration and strikes, but I will explain as I now am there with Lenin's critique. So in 1906, Lenin summarized the lessons of 1905, and he asked the question, why did the revolution fail? And in summary, we did cover this last time, because the peaceful strikes and demonstrations, he said, were, quote, out of date, meaning they were not only ineffective and brought the violence unto the people who were unarmed, but also the state was able to meet them and suppress them.
Right.
And so why did the revolution fail? Because of this, and because the Moscow unions had voted for insurrection, but the Social Democrat leaders, mainly this was a Menshevik's administration, let's call it, and in Lenin's words, had disorganized these insurrection. In other words, had not only not organized them, but disorganized them, because... And also it failed because the masses were way ahead of the backward leadership, of backward in the sense of timorous, fearful, and,
unprepared. They didn't have a military strategy when they were basically entering a military situation.
The military strategy is key because they were there. I mean, there could have been a military uprising. And also because the state was no longer impressed by the strikes, etc. So what Lenin concluded, which had already been in his important essay, What is to be Done, in 1902, and he reiterated in the second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party in 1903, what was needed, what should have been there, and what must be built in the future, was a vanguard party. So let me just, before we comment, just define some of these terms, because we know that the party itself has been the target of Western demonization. The party is a bunch of dictators. The party acts in obscurity. The party, it's a top-down government and all these things.
Right.
Okay, so actually in this program, we're going to talk a great deal about the need for a party and for a revolutionary party, according to Lenin. So what is the vanguard party? Vanguardism is a strategy whereby the most class-conscious and politically advanced sections of the proletariat or working class are described as the revolutionary vanguard, and they form organizations in order to draw larger sections of the working class towards revolutionary politics and serve as manifestations, this party, as actual presences of proletarian political power against its class enemies. That's vanguardism according to general definition. Now, Lenin said, he saw, this is, of course, what split the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks in 1903.
Right.
This is very important this discussion about the party. In 1903, the Mensheviks said, well, you know, why should we need this secret small party? That's what split them. And this keeps coming up. So now Lenin is saying, look what happened in 1905. The absence of an organizing structure and the absence of, you know, the masses had to come to their own class consciousness and had nowhere to turn to act on that class consciousness, for example. So Lenin said that, quote, the history of all countries bears out the fact that through their own powers alone, the working class cannot develop, can only develop a trade union consciousness. We did talk about this last time.
Yes.
That means that the working class is not born a revolutionary class in the sense that they don't know about proletariat dictatorship. They're not, you know, if they're given a decent wage, etc., they will calm down. And as we said last time, these things then that they have gained will be taken away in an economic crisis, in a political crisis, etc. And he said that under reformist trade union leadership, the working class could only engage in local rebellions to improve their political position within the capital system, and that revolutionary consciousness developed unevenly. Lenin said that the missing element for escalating the class struggle to the point of insurrection and revolution was a political organization. So since what is to be done through 1903, now 1906, he's insisting on this. And because a party, he saw a party as an instructive organization. He said, you know, you must have a revolutionary theory because without it, you cannot have a revolutionary movement.
Right.
And as I will mention later, in a minute or so, this is what the reformists, the social democrat, don't have. They don't have a revolutionary theory, or they don't want a revolutionary theory.
Right.
They just have movements. So Lenin says, class political consciousness is not a spontaneous growth, but come to the workers only from without, from the party. That is, you know, instituting teaching classes, night classes, and the underground press, etc. So, did you want to say something?
Yeah, let me just summarize a couple of sentences here that'll sort of frame where we're going next. I think I understand. Okay, first of all, you know, the conditions, you know, that faced workers in Russia were horrendous, okay? And so this is what motivates all of this unrest. And also, in any event, let's just say, so there is a
and
great deal
of... And they just lost the Japanese War.
Right. There's war, there's all kinds of things, that, you know, there's an industrialization process that's been underway for some time, and in any event, all right, so there is this unrest. And so people go into the streets, so they say... First of all, let's have a strike and demonstrations. They organize them. They spontaneously erupt. You know, suddenly there's a bunch of people in the streets. They call strikes and they have demonstrations. Well, guess what? Those are fun. They feel satisfying, immediately satisfying. You know, like, wow, isn't that something? I remember the sensation I had on February 15th, 2003, when even though there was a blizzard and it was freezing cold the day before and the day of, it was freezing cold, showing up in New York City and seeing that there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that showed up, that, wow, the sentiment that I have...
Supposedly 250,000, but I'm sure there were more.
It was massive, and just, that felt fantastic. It was an emotional high that lasted for weeks. Great. Guess what? When your problem is that people have just been killed in your family in a war that was pointless, and that you're hungry, and that there's no solution to that, maybe you don't have a job, your very situation is precarious or worse, after the demonstration is over and maybe you go have a couple of drinks with your friends, tomorrow you wake up in the same condition. It does not satisfy you. And so you ask, what is to be done next? And that is what Lenin said. What do we do next?
Yeah.
And they said, do something more resolute. Well, there was no one prepared to organize for the next step. And the people, you're fighting for control of the society when you fight for these things. There's somebody that's benefiting from your misery. And just because you complain about it, even if you demonstrate outside their house, they're not going to change it. They'll shoot you if they have to instead. And you have to be prepared for all of these things. And that means you have to have some people that can assess it, that have the technological skill to look at a military action and know what to do with these people that don't have that many arms to deal with the military action or the political action. Or when the guy comes with a checkbook and says, come on, I'm taking everybody drinking this afternoon. Or because Lenin says one of the things they did, they bought people off with vodka. They doped them with vodka. They lied to them. They confined the soldiers to the barracks. Yes. They kept the soldiers out of it, for example. Lenin says we should have been trying to organize the military because those guys are in the same boat as the rest of the workers. There was no one doing this.
Yeah, as 1917 proved.
Right. Well, Lenin details all of this. They build the party. The party takes this role on. And in 1917, when this pops up again, these conditions.
Opportunity, yeah.
This time, there's a plan and there's a leadership to walk through the plan. And they can deal with, well, now they're throwing the military at us. Oh, we organized the military. Now they're trying to starve us out. Oh, we can break through with things that we've developed to get transport food and things.
Stored, yeah.
Exactly, all of it. You have to have a strategy.
Yeah, and all of these were approved in committees. All of
right.
these motions, as we will see
right.
when we talk about 1917, how I know how organized they were. They were.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, the difference between the Bolsheviks as they evolved and the Mensheviks as they evolved is really the difference between a communist and a social democrat as a liberal, you know,
right.
as a sort of maybe more left liberal. So we have to realize that for Lenin, the objective of a revolution now, it took a long time for Lenin to inform the party. It took until practically the eve of the revolution to say we must seize power. Before that, even Lenin and the Mensheviks believed that there should be a transition, a bourgeois period,
right.
a period of capitalist development. But
right.
the Menshevik took this period to be ad infinitum.
Right.
So, you know, we have to realize that there was a dispute in the party between how to achieve the revolution and for Lenin, the party had to have a revolutionary objective and eventually the seizure of political power, which came to him in April 1917.
Right. Let me just interrupt on this point. Let me clarify. What you just said is that it came to Lenin that there should be an objective for a revolutionary in a revolution. That objective is to win. The point of being involved in a revolution is to win the revolution.
Yes.
That means to attain, to seize power.
Overthrow. Yeah, and that seizure of power desire is misrepresented in Western propaganda as a individualist kind of drive.
Right.
Whereas we have to understand that for him, the objective of seizing political power was a means to secure the interest of the subaltern classes,
the
oppressed classes.
Class, that's right. Yep.
That is, it was a means to empower these classes. This is the unconditional point of Lenin. It wasn't for his own grandeur,
right.
you know, as
exactly.
it's represented. It was an ethical position, and it informs all of Lenin's thought, though he changes because he is a genius revolutionary. You know, he understands that situations change. That in 1905 you might say, oh well, we're underdeveloped and we, you know, okay, we'll have a kind of bourgeois revolution. But then he saw what happened with the bourgeois revolution of February 1917, right, and how they were going to continue the war, and how it was just you know, a passage that. And it was a moment that could be seized and tried, and we'll get there.
Right.
Now, he said that the organizational task of the revolutionaries must consist first and foremost of people who make revolutionary activity their profession. That means you have to read Marx, you have to discuss, you have to know what Marxism is. That's what he means by theory, which is completely lacking from any left in America. And,
oh, yeah,
you know, what do we lack? We lack a theory of revolution. Why do we lack it? Because we don't have a party. Because the party was, you know, electrocuted with the Rosenbergs because Khrushchev came along. And so we have no communism, except, you know, no communist party. No. And it was intentional. It was important to destroy the party here and everywhere else. Slower in Europe, and here it was dealt a blow, small as it was. Anyway, professional means, you know, knowing the theory. And he also said that all distinctions as between workers and intellectuals, not to speak of trade and professions, must be effaced. Such an organization, and this is, must perforce not be very extensive, eh? It must be small, which is what right. The Menshevik objected to, and must be as secret as possible under right. The condition of the Tsarist autocracy.
Right.
The key, says Lenin, is leadership. Without the dozen tried and talented leaders, and talented men are not born by the hundreds, he says, professionally trained, schooled by long experience, and working in perfect harmony, no class in modern society can wage a determined struggle. And look at our bourgeois class. They have think tanks, they have foundations, they have meetings, they stretch out to London, and they have organizations all over the world that promote their interests.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the key is leadership. But this does not mean that there was no participation. This leadership was to bring the consciousness of the working class beyond trade unionism by inviting them, by organizing activities in which they would be radicalized, in which they would see not their own personal interests, their family interests, but the interests of themselves as a class. That's all misunderstood and
yep.
distorted in the West.
Yep.
So...
Well, of course.
He did.
Of course it is.
Sorry, go ahead.
Of course it is. This is a roadmap, you know, in sketch terms and of roads that are not the ones that we're traveling. They're just, look, it's yeah. a roadmap of some different roads that existed 100 years ago, but it's a roadmap, even that much we're not allowed to see, that gets from here
yeah.
to here. And the point is, because you'll almost never hear anyone say this, because it's something that must be 1,000 years away, according to their models.
Yeah.
The purpose of revolution is to win. It's the objective. It's to win and take power for the class. And
that's
if you're not working on that project, you're really not, you're not a revolutionary for sure.
And you talk to any American left intellectual, you mention Communist Party, and they sniff, you know,
yep.
I mean, they sneer.
Yep.
This is so embedded that a party that's called Communist Party, because we don't have a bourgeois party.
Mm.
So we think, oh, this is natural or whatever, you know.
Right.
They don't admit that the bourgeoisie is tremendously organized
right.
into a party to keep their power in their own hands.
Right.
The bourgeoisie has a party. It's called the Republican Democratic Party in
right.
America.
Right.
It's one party.
Yep.
You know, it's a yep. proletariat of the bourgeoisie.
Yep.
But mention Communist Party in America, and that's why I keep mentioning it. No, I wasn't born here. I know that people can have different political views. But here, there is a really indoctrinated, engineered disassociation from any kind of working class organization where, you know, the bourgeoisie can join. So one time Lenin said, I don't remember the date, but I'm sure he said it more often than his thought. He said there can be no socialism without democracy.
Right.
But he didn't mean, you know, he didn't mean bourgeois democracy. There can be no society without consent and kind of majoritarian consent. So he recognized that the secrecy is contradictory to democratic participation. But he also argues that while the secrecy must be limited, it's still necessary. He says, and this is for Russia and doesn't apply so much to us, but yet. And as you say, it is a roadmap. And I insist the first thing to do is to educate ourselves or have somebody educate ourselves in theory and then form a party.
Right.
But anyway, he said, to concentrate all secret function in the hands of as small a number of professional revolutionaries as possible does not mean that the latter will do all the thinking for all and that the rank and file will not take an active part in the movement. He argues that the effectiveness of the secret revolutionary leadership will actually increase participation by the masses through their reading of illegal press and taking part in demonstrations, as I mentioned before. Still, he acknowledges that he will be criticized, and boy, was he, first by the Trotskyists and then by the whole Western world. Now, we have to contrast, in order to understand better the birth pangs of socialism in Russia, we have to try to understand what the Mensheviks were thinking. And really, when you look at it, they're not different from the Social Democrats of Europe. So we contrast Lenin's revolutionary position, that word is always there, with his opponents. The Mensheviks, along these crucial years, really revealed themselves to be social reformists and at crucial times, counter-revolutionaries. And that will come up, if we ever get to today, to World War One. I mean, that's the most scandalous moment of the betrayal of the social reformist who joined the war. And so he says, at crucial time, they acted as counter-revolutionaries. I mean, Whiz, who put down the German Revolution of 1920, 23, or whatever the date was? The Social Democrats. And certainly, and this is important for us to understand, these reformists are certainly not anti-imperialistic, as we will see. Right. And again, it will come up when I mention the First World War.
Right.
When I talk about the betrayal of socialism, what did they do? They went to war for each nation in imperialist wars. Why do we have social democrats in America and Democrats that are imperialist? Well, there's a long reason for this. There's a long history for this. If we knew it, we would say, oh, I see,
right.
You know?
That's right.
So now we don't know what Trotsky truly believed. These years are full of Lenin's put-downs of Trotsky. Lenin claimed that he didn't think much of Trotsky's theory and even of his commitment to revolution, to the working class. He saw him as a weather vane, always siding with the majority when he was not busy, as he will be from 1906 to 1914, splitting left groups or splitting groups into various groups.
Right.
At any rate, both in 1903 and in 1905 in Petersburg, Trotsky sided with temperance, you know, with the moderates,
right.
With the Mensheviks.
It's not
yet
time.
He called off the general strike.
Right. It's not time. It's too soon.
Yeah.
Which becomes self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's it.
And it's self-fulfilling prophecy, because when you do that, when you call off the dogs, then you lose, and then he says, see?
That's right. Yeah. So how exactly was the revolution to come about? Well, it wasn't, according to the Mensheviks. Nicely, slowly, you know, almost absentmindedly. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, it's a stroll.
Since 1903, they had been opposed to such a revolutionary party. They opposed Lenin's proposal. That's where they split. Whereas Lenin understood that there would be no security for workers and peasants without the seizing of power. Eventually, that became very clear to him. The Mensheviks trusted in the evolution, in the future evolution of capitalism. It would, be fade away somehow.
Yeah, well, there are all kinds of fantasies that they still push. The democratization of stock ownership, for example. You know, hear like, well, workers now actually own the means of production through their 401ks and all this kind of nonsense. Of course, you know, if you ask 10 workers about their 401k, nine of them are going to say, my what?
Yeah.
One of them will say, oh, yeah, I do. I have some stock. I saw it right before I got laid off from my job at IBM or whatever. I had a 401k and there's some stocks in there. Yep. That's it.
Yep,
that's all they know.
Out
of those 10 people, a generation ago, four of them owned businesses. That's the actual fact on the ground. And this is the same. These are the same fantasies that were being spun in 1905 and again upcoming into 1917. And not just in
Europe,
Russia,
in
here, the whole run up to the Great Depression and the stock market crash was built on exactly that same foundation, that all you had to do was hang in there with capitalism and everybody was going to be fabulously well-to-do and wealthy. And we are out of time for this week. We'll come to this again next week and pick it up here, and we're going to dive into, I guess we'll dive into 1906 to 1914 at that point after we finish tagging 1905.
So.
Okay, Luciana, thank you so much. A pleasure as always.
Pleasure is all mine. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to 2018. We did it. We did it, huh? I wasn't sure we'd make it, but we got to the final New Year's. This is exciting. It's exciting. Well, you guys got depressed on that one. All right. It's going to be a rough show. If that got you down, we're in trouble. But here we are. Here we are. We got it. We made it. It was kind of a rough year. Not a lot to celebrate, you know, with our slimy con artist president with his head so far up his... He's getting to fracking levels, really. He's so deep now. I mean, you get deep enough, you can find new forms of fuel in there. He's so far up his own ass, he's causing minor earthquakes in nearby towns. But I want to make this segment about the good news from last year. I actually did see a lot of hope and promise and success in the past year. I mean... not enough to beat the misery and despair, but still, it was something. It was something. I'm going to start with the obvious good news, the obvious one. Chelsea Manning was released in 2017, and she continues to be a voice for equality and justice. Also, the first set of J20 defendants were found not guilty last month. Furthermore, marijuana is now legal in California, which is one of the largest economies in the world. And no, that doesn't mean the fight to keep it out of corporate hands is over. And no, it doesn't mean everybody already arrested for having a f***ing joint is released instantly. But this is still a big step for a number of reasons. Let's go through a few of them. Let's start with freedom. How about freedom? You should be free. You should be free to smoke a f***ing joint on your patio in your underwear in this so-called free country. A plant that makes a lot of people mildly happy, all right? That, No, we can't have that. You could wave a gun around and threaten to kill people at an elementary school bake sale. That's fine. But you can't eat a pot rice crispy treat that makes you act not like a d***. Like, we have a ton of d***s in this country. Our cup runneth over with d***s, all right? So anything that decreases the d*** ratio should be supported and cheered on and probably subsidized too, okay? You know, let's take some of that money that we dump into war and factory farming or the congressional sauna used to steam Tim Kaine's bag. Let's take some of that money and instead pay for everyone to get a bong hit, okay? On top of that, the war on drugs is nothing but a racist charade. I've talked about that a lot on this show. Also, new studies show hospitalization rates of people suffering from painkiller abuse and addiction dropped on average 23% in states with marijuana. More good news from 2017. In July, the UN ratified the first legally binding international agreement to ban nuclear weapons. The group that helped make it happen also won a Nobel Peace Prize, which was a nice move for the Nobel Committee to stop doling those things out to war criminals like Henry Kissinger and Barack Obama and Bob Dylan. Okay. Dylan's not a war criminal, but he puts no efforts into his concerts these days, all right? I didn't pay $150 to watch the back of an old man's head as he death rattles his way through hurricane. F*** you, Nobel Committee. Another great thing about 2017, Bitcoin blew up, all right? It blew up. It went through the roof. If you owned 40 cents of Bitcoin at the beginning of 2017, then you're currently not watching this because you're drunk on a yacht somewhere wearing underpants made out of the carcasses of endangered three-toed, ring-tailed, pygmy lemur hippos. But that's not the point. The reason cryptocurrencies matter is because they take money out of the hands of central governments and big banks, which have a national need, it's their prerogative to create war and conflict and keep a large percentage of the people of our society struggling. I learned that from History. I learned that from history, yeah. And the cryptocurrency surge is not just a trend. It's the future. Basically, at the very least, cryptocurrency is to dollars what Napster was to buying a CD, or masturbation is to going to a museum. You know, the second one seems like a good idea until someone tells you about the other one. And you're like, I got lotion, I'll stay here. I'll have more on cryptocurrency in an upcoming show. Another positive from 2017, the rise of basic income, getting paid simply for being a citizen. It's not a loony idea anymore, all right? People are talking about it. Elon Musk has promoted it. Peter Joseph, Stephen Hawking, even Zuckerberg's on board. The writing is on the wall. Basic income, look, basic income will not stop unfettered capitalism from eating itself, but it's a step in the right direction. Every job will be replaced by bots and 3D printers in the next, 30 years. Doesn't matter what you do or how awesome you are at it or how passionate you are at it, a bot will do it better in a few years, okay? And it'll do it with none of the attitude, none of the sick days, none of the sexual harassment lawsuits. Misogynistic dunghole bosses won't have to worry about a bot being like, my optical scanners are up here, douchebag, all right? Stop looking at my outlets. Look, we have the technology to feed, clothe, house, and take care of everyone, whether there are jobs for everyone or not. And once we've done that, rather than being miserable because our lives suck, we can be miserable for completely meaningless reasons, the way God intended, you know? Like your best friend flirted with your girl or your boy or the new superhero movie didn't live up to the hype or whatever the f***, you know? You know what else continued to grow in 2017? Electric car ownership, clean energy, biking to work, alternative media sources, the movement to bring down the Confederate monuments, acceptance of gay and transgender community, of the gay and transgender community. Granted, they still have a very hard time. I'm not trying to say it's easy, but at least the remaining states that hate gay people tend to be the states that no one wants to be in anyway. And 2017 saw incredible scientific breakthroughs. For example, Chinese scientists teleported a photon from the Earth to space for the first time. This has to do with quantum entanglement, which occurs when two quantum objects, such as photons, share a wave function. Since they come into existence at the exact same time and place, they share the same identity, even when separated. What happens to one happens to the other wherever it exists. I feel like this is the type of advancement that 99% of us don't understand until one day Jeff Bezos teleports into every living room in America instantaneously. And then we're like, I should have read up on this. What the f*** is going on? But most importantly, 2017 saw an explosion of grassroots organizing, protest, and activism. There were major victories for the BDS movement, putting pressure on Israel to treat Palestinians like human beings for a change. The Black Lives Matter movement continued to call attention to police brutality and systemic racism. And activist Tarana Burke's Me Too movement is helping to change our society. Both of those movements are big steps for traditionally oppressed groups. Sure, there are issues with any movement that need to be resolved. I'm sure there are people in Black Lives Matter who think President Obama was a savior just because of his skin color. Doesn't matter that he continued the militarization of the police and the prison industrial complex, which is a crime against humanity. Now, we'll look past all of that because he fist bumped Jay-Z at the White House Christmas dinner. That's all that really matters, you know? Obama made the racist imperial system go down smooth. He really did. He was the pickle juice to the imperial whiskey burn. All right? You ever had pickle juice with whiskey? I know it sounds weird, but it's sublime. And there are people in the Me Too movement who unknowingly are, you know, degrade the horror of rape by acting like some saying nice is the same thing. They're both wrong. They're not the same thing. But despite these issues, Black Lives Matter and Me Too are all in all wonderful advancements in our society. Then there's the so-called, yes. Then there's the so-called resistance movements, which on the national level largely means f*** all right? And it has been a way for corporate Democrats to act like they're doing anything at all to stop fascism, meanwhile endorsing Trump's wars, his war powers, his surveillance powers, his big bank-run economy, and more. But on the local level, in various cities, the resistance actually can mean something. True progressives actually can and are winning victories at the ballot box. While the federal government is bought off, change can still occur at a lower level. Don't give up. Just hang in there long enough for the nerds to figure out how to use the quantum entanglement teleporter to zip us to another planet with more peace and equality and far fewer orange oligarchs. Coming to you from Washington, D.C., the Bellevue Beast is redacted tonight.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome. Welcome. I'm Lee Camp. Now let's take the news from behind. And now that we're done with the good news, let's get to the blisteringly awful, make you want to take a warm bath with a toaster kind of news. The head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, issued a red alert for 2018, pointing to growing inequality, the impacts of climate change, and global anxiety about nuclear weapons. Apparently, the Donald didn't get the memo as he rang in the new year bragging that his nuclear button is bigger and more powerful than Kim Jong-un's. Well, maybe it is. But who wants to bet Trump's button is flaccid with warts all over it? Smells like expired goat cheese. Yeah, people trying to avoid looking at it when they walk in the Oval Office. It's like, oh, God. But don't worry about the UN's red alert. We have agencies here in the U.S. to protect us, like the FBI, the good old FBI. They celebrated the new year by boasting that they stopped a terrorist attack in San Francisco. The only problem is the FBI helped create the plot, and then the plotter wouldn't even go through with it. He told them, "I don't think I can do this after all. I've reconsidered." Oh. Isn't that the worst? You create a fake terrorist attack so that you can stop it and look like a hero, and then the stupid patsy won't even go through with his end of it, so then you gotta pretend he was gonna do it, and then you gotta double pretend to stop him. Don't you hate when that happens? But the FBI and other agencies have to keep up the fake terror stuff so that they can justify the completely illegal surveillance they do on us. It just came out that in 9 U.S. cities, airports are already using facial scans. Really? Facial scans? I don't know. I don't think it's for a facial scan when the TSA agent is cupping my b****s. I don't think, you know, unless the government wants to make sure to have images of every American looking like this. You know, that should honestly be the new American flag. Just a guy at airport security with his pants around his ankles making this face. Well, hello. But of course, it's not just at the airport that our privacy is being invaded. It was revealed this week that hundreds of smartphone apps are monitoring users through their microphones without telling them. Now, that sounds bad, but it is better that corporate America monitor you through your microphone than what they used to do, which was watch you through your bedroom window. You know, this is real, spying on you through your phone is the kinder, gentler corporate totalitarian states. It's the pickle juice with the whiskey. Moving on, in a huge show of cooperation, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and all of the mainstream corporate media and all of our governmental agencies and all of the corporate politicians came together this week to say they stand with the Iranian people and they are very concerned about the human rights abuses over there. And you know, just speaking, just as a human being, it's really great to see basically 100% of our normally grotesque, greedy, belligerent, morally bankrupt vipers, you know, ruling elite bags speaking out in support of an oppressed people. Because there's clearly no ulterior motive here at all. They are doing what's right, just as they did with Libya and Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and Korea and Vietnam and Chile and Indonesia. Oh, or maybe our military-industrial complex, which owns our politicians and our media, wants Iran to collapse into a war-torn, failed state, killing hundreds of thousands of people, same way Syria did. You know, just spitballing here, just a little huncheroony, just a bit of a flight of fancy, guesstimazioni. This is not to say these aren't genuine protests going on in Iran. They are, just like we have genuine protests here in our country. But the idea that our hack politicians give a shit about the Iranian people is laughable. They don't even care about Americans. Makes you think they care about Iranians. And if they did care about Americans, they would immediately start doing something about climate change, for example. And the fact that a new study predicts a quarter of the world will be drought-ridden by 2050. But have no fear. Trump has a big, fat, limp nuclear button, and he plans to bomb the out of that drought. We have to go to a quick break, but you can get all of our videos at youtube.com/redacted tonight. We'll be right back.
Woo! What'd you have for breakfast yesterday? Why would you pick those shoes? How fast is your Wi-Fi? What's your dog's name? Why'd you name him that? What's your biggest fear in life? Ever been on a hayride? When's the last time you read a book? What would you say if you ever met the Pope?
Oh,
who's the best quarterback of all time? What's one topping that doesn't belong on a pizza? Now, I've interviewed you too. Question more.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard.
To get government out of business, the Trump administration is rolling back federal fines on nursing homes that put seniors at risk for serious injury or death. Trump's a businessman, though. You know, if he could find a way to open an Etsy page to sell off your grandpa's wig to fund his golf trips, I think he would have done it by now. For more on this, we turn to our senior nursing home expert, Natalie McGill. Natalie. I think you'll agree with me on this. I don't think the guy who should be in a nursing home should be making decisions about nursing homes.
Oh, but Lee, he has a point. These fines are a burden to nursing homes. Ask the seniors. If anyone knows what it's like to be a burden to the adult children they raised, it's them. Okay, over 500 nursing homes alone have federal fines above $100,000. And nursing home lobbyists hate regulations.
Wait, what was that last one?
I said nursing home lobbyists hate regulations.
Are you mumbling lobbyists? Yeah, the f***ing of course they hate regulation. That's... They work for the parasites getting rich off of this scam. If they could find a way to store your Nana in a broom closet and make the same amount of money, they would do it. Fines that normally would total hundreds of thousands of dollars would only be tens of thousands with this change, even in cases where patients could die.
Okay, come on, Lee. It's not like the staff working in these homes set out to be nurse ratchets in training, right? They're just victims of a up nursing home model.
They're the victims.
Yes. See, nearly 75% of U.S. nursing homes are owned by people who outsource services seniors need, like physical therapy, to companies they control. By eliminating competition, nursing homes are charged way more for these services while the owners collect the profits. But a Kaiser Health News investigation found homes that outsource this way have fewer nurses and aides per patient, higher rates of patient injuries and unsafe practices, and are the subject of complaints almost twice as often as independent homes. Finding these nursing homes is pointless when the owners care more about profit than making sure they're staffed with nurses who care enough to burst their eye blood vessels while teaching my mom how to use an iPad. Or an arts and crafts director that gives my grandma more mediums to work with than sidewalk chalk.
She's very talented, I thought. Not all regulations should be painted with the same broad brush here. These fines ultimately exposed negligent care of our most vulnerable citizens. It's not a senior's fault that the corporations that own these homes would rather use them as cash cows instead of spending that money on staffing to make sure that they were actually compliant.
Okay, then what the f*** are we supposed to do? All right. Because 40 years from now, there will be 98 million people aged 65 and older. All right, it's gonna be raining Viagra and fake teeth, and only one of those will be covered by Medicaid.
We have plenty of money to take care of our parents and grandparents in this society. For the cost of one F-35 bomber, you could take care of every senior on the East Coast, all right? or help pay those people's adult children to have the resources to take care of their own parents.
Okay, yeah, it's true. If society made it easier to keep my mom at home, I would do it. Only I'm spending extra cash for a home health aide to teach my mom how to use an iPad so she can look at photos of children who would treat her better.
That's fair. Natalie McGill, everyone. Moving on, Facebook continues their wave of repression against outside voices. We go now to Naomi Caravani for the raging controversy. We're all sick, time wasted.
I dream of a time when we are no longer citizens of the U.S., Lebanon, or Luxembourg, but we are all citizens of the internet. I call this UtopiNet. My passport would be issued by Reddit in the format of HTML 5.1 second edition subreddit beta cuck. But Facebook is deleting accounts at the direction of the US and Israeli governments. They're deleting people's accounts because a country told them to? I thought we were just purging bots who failed the CAPTCHA test. Haha, nice try, you sack of steel. Don't quit your day job counting how many steps I took today. Facebook recently removed the leader of the Chechen Republic's Facebook and Instagram accounts. So was Facebook appalled by Kadyrov's hatred of human rights and love for small animals? He's corrupt, and he gives a bad name to cosplay. No. Facebook shut down his accounts because he had just been added to a U.S. sanctions list. The new censorship. It's now global and America's number one export. Soon you'll have to enter the new CAPTCHA code. Do you agree with America's post 9/11 foreign policy agenda? Last year, Facebook met with far right-wing Israeli officials and agreed to delete Palestinian Facebook accounts inciting violence. Israel blamed attacks on Israelis on these Facebook accounts, since, as we all know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict started when the tribe of Zuckerberg migrated from Cambridge to the Silicon Valley in the year 2004. Tel Aviv had submitted 158 requests in only 4 months asking to remove content it deemed incitement. Facebook granted 95%. And that seems fine if they were all calls to murder Jews. I personally would prefer not to be murdered. But many news networks and journalists disappeared from the social media network overnight, such as the Palestinian Dialogue Network, Gaza Now, the Jerusalem News Network, and the Shihab Agency, among many others. Facebook apologized and said it was an accident. The official statement read, "Whoops, we're sorry, we got a little too involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict, but it's your high school friend who you fell hopelessly out of touch with Ahmed's birthday on Saturday." Okay, you're right, it's incredibly unfair to Palestinians to shut down their news sources, especially when 96% of Palestinians get their news from social media, but check out this newborn baby. You like it? Do you love it? To protest, Palestinian activists took to Twitter, which is now facing its own accusations of towing the government line. And they rightly showed that Facebook was not at all censoring the hate speech of Israelis. For example, Zuckerberg failed to act when a campaign of vengeance against Arabs went viral on the social network, where hundreds photographed themselves and a cat holding signs urging retribution for the killing of Israelis. And we're still waiting on Cosmo's apology. Cosmo? Much of the hate speech against Arabs has been incited by the Israeli rapper The Shadow, who has 340,000 followers on his page. That fetching mother should be removed from Facebook. She's setting a bad example for Jews who want peace and rapping Jewish mothers everywhere. She may sully the name of Band of Bubbies. The solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is obvious. Just and that will save the children. Reporting from this is Naomi Caravani. Tonight. We're all sick, time wasted.
Here your headlines from the future, coming up tomorrow. 5,000 Iranian protesters link hands to spell out U.S. don't help. And on Thursday, desperate FBI takes out Craigslist ad for highly motivated Patsy. And 1 month from now, Chinese scientists accidentally quantum entangle Mariah Carey in a one-legged ostrich, creating only slightly more unusual Mariah Carey. That's our show, but you can get web-exclusive videos and more by texting the word redacted to 444-999. It's free in the U.S. You can also get our show every week on DirecTV, channel 321. Until next time, good night, and keep fighting.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.